Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger for discussing Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your 10th grade reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me is returning co-host, Erin Gambrill.
Hello.
Hi there. could you remind everyone out there who you are? And
yeah. So I used to host a podcast called Ladies Who Library. It's been on hiatus for about 2 years now, so you know, anyone's guess if that's ever coming back. I say that as if I had no control over that, but I just, you know, I've taken a break. So now I'm just your local friendly online librarian. So I'm a children's librarian, and I think I was on for Winesburg, Ohio.
We had discussed maybe possibly coming back and doing Spoon River Anthology, but But I actually suggested this book this time, which is Kenneth Graham's 1908, The Wind in the Willows, because I had a hankering to read a kid's book. I've been reading a lot of dour Victorian novels, and I thought maybe this would cheer me up.
Yeah.
And this is a book you know well, or is this the first time you've read this?
I actually listened to it earlier in the year. Before we had even chatted, I think, about talking about this book. But I don't think I read this as a kid or anything. I think it was just like one of those books that you know the stories from, because there are some like multiple stories within there. And I knew the characters, but I don't know that I've ever read it through. Actually, I was thinking today, I think I always get these characters confused with Lobel's Frog and Toad.
Well,
which I'm more familiar with because those are, you know, beginning readers.
Well, I think you could draw a line of influence from Kenneth Graham down to the modern day anthropomorphic animals. Graham wrote this, as I said, in 1908. So we're talking Edwardian England.
Yeah.
There's a kind of a shift, I think. You know, if you're the kind of person who's read a lot of Victorian kids stuff, like certainly Peter Pan or mm-hmm. the Alice books or things mm-hmm. like that, you can notice a shift that happens starting with Graham that certainly went on to influence Milne in Winnie the Pooh. It's a lot more.
Yeah.
It's a lot drier. The, mm-hmm. the humor is kind of, is a lot more based upon psychology, and particularly mm-hmm. British psychology and issues of class.
Mm-hmm.
But there is this thing about Graham, which is it holds on to, I think, a Victorian romanticism.
Yeah.
Now you do readings at your library. Is this the kind of book you would read at
yes.
your library, or do you read on?
No. So we do. I do story time, which is mostly for a way younger audience than would have the attention span for this. I honestly don't know the age kid. I mean, I think this is more of like a school age kid, like before bed. You know, if they're still into that at like age 8, like 7 or 8. I mean, I just can't imagine a kid younger than that, like getting any of these, like even the funny parts, which I think there's a lot of humor in this book that like I literally laughed out loud. But I don't know. I just can't imagine them relating that much other than, isn't it silly that a toad drives a car? Sort of thing. So yeah, this is not a book that I would read at the library.
Yeah, it's a very strange book. I think most people in this country, if they haven't read the book, will be familiar with the Disney film
yes.
Ichabod and Mr. Toad, which had mm-hmm. in a very strange two-part movie, half of an adaptation of The Legend of Sleepy Hollow and half an adaptation of the Toad parts of this book. And if you only knew that movie, you might be fooled into thinking that Toad was the main character in this book.
Mm-hmm.
Or that's what the tone of this book is.
Yeah.
I love Ichabod and Mr. Toad. I think it's one of the, I would actually call it my favorite Disney film. I think that was like,
wow.
Well, I have a soft spot for post-war Disney sure. animation. And I think that was like the, I think that both of those were strange stories and they weren't princess stories. So I love them both.
Yeah. No, I'm just, the wow is more that I'm honored to be on the episode where you admit your favorite Disney movie.
Well, yeah, but as much as I love that Disney movie and as much as I love the dear departed Mr. Toad's Wild Ride, mm-hmm. which I don't think exists anymore. For mm-hmm. a while it was at Disneyland, but not at Disney World. I think it's completely gone now, but I may be wrong. Disney files out there, tell me if Mr. Toad's Wild Ride exists anymore. But as much as I love that ride and I love the movie, this is a very strange book and a very...
Yeah.
you know, it's strange in the way that if you actually roll up your sleeves and read Barry's Peter Pan rather than like see the a play production and you start to puzzle through what's happening in the book, it's a weird book.
Well, and it's funny because I was thinking, I mean, I think there's definitely a lot of ties to that and like Alice in Wonderland, and that the fact they were all written for like one child in mind. Like, cause so I was reading a little bit more about Kenneth Graham and that he had written this for his son and it was kind of like a bedtime story that he then had like, you know, expanded upon. And like, I don't know, that's a really interesting thing to think of is like these books being written for a single audience. And so maybe we can get some clue as to like what that specific child was like based on these like these bonkers texts. I don't know.
Right. And Kenneth Graham wrote this in his retirement, mm-hmm. having retired from being a banker. What an odd, you know, world that's the case, that he goes off and he retires. He retires to the Thames Valley and takes mm-hmm. up boating, and he writes a book that is in many ways about a celebration of Thames Valley culture. Now, when I read this, I was thinking to myself, oh, you know, I have these pictures of people punting. I mean, this book doesn't actually feature punting. This book features rowboating, which is the difference being if you punt, you push your boat along sort of like a gondola with a long pole,
mm-hmm.
and rowing is you row. But I was wondering, is at the time he was writing this book, was this already sort of a nostalgic world? Because I think of boating along the Thames as being a Victorian thing, you know, and it certainly is associated with the first Alice book. And then I looked online, and no, there's still a vibrant Thames boating culture to this day.
Oh, I'm sure.
So,
I mean, I've watched every single episode of Midsummer Murders like 3 times. So I believe like that there are many, many forms of like those, like, I don't know, sporting related sub communities, like based around rowing and cricket and all that stuff.
This is a book, and it certainly does feature Toad or mm-hmm. Mr. Toad, but it
the well-known and popular Mr. Toad,
right? But it's I would say that it's primarily a book about Ratty, who was a water rat,
yes,
which mm-hmm. is not an actual rat, nor yet is it a muskrat. It's a mm-hmm. kind of a vole that lives in Britain, and mole or the mole. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I find very hard to put my finger on this book is the way that Graham handles anthropomorphism.
Yes. No, I totally agree. Sometimes it's like they acknowledge, like, it seems like the world is just, it's just them. It's just animals, like, as if humans weren't around, and they wear, yeah, clothes like animals do and blah, blah, blah. But then they really sometimes lean into, like, the animalistic nature of, like, you know, they sleep during, some of them sleep during the winter, and some of them like to live in caves and stuff. And so, and then humans do feature, and they, one gets mistaken for a human. So yeah, it's sort of a loose, there's loose rules here.
Right. And the narrative voice sometimes will refer to them as rat and mole. Sometimes will refer to them as the rat or the mole. And they take on animal characteristics or human characteristics as is necessary.
Yeah.
Every time I read this book again, I am shocked by the opening, because the opening starts with Mole literally erupting from the earth. Yeah. And the implication is, up till now, all he has ever done in his life is lived underground and had absolutely no contact with anything else in the world.
The mole had been working very hard all the morning, spring cleaning his little home. First with brooms, then with dusters, then on ladders and steps and chairs, with a brush and a pail of whitewash, till he had dust in his throat and eyes, and splashes of whitewash all over his black fur, and an aching back and weary arms. Spring was moving in the air above and in the earth below and around him, penetrating even his dark and lowly little house with its spirit of divine discontent and longing. It was small wonder, then, that he suddenly flung down his brush on the floor, said, "Bother!" and "Oh, blow!" and also, "Hang spring cleaning!" and bolted out of the house without even waiting to put on his coat. Something up above was calling him imperiously, and he made for the steep little tunnel which answered, in his case, to the graveled carriage drive owned by animals whose residences are nearer to the sun and air. So he scraped and scratched and scrabbled and scrooged, and then he scrooged again and scrabbled and scratched and scraped, working busily with his little paws and muttering to himself, up we go, till at last, pop! His snout came out into the sunlight, and he found himself rolling in the warm grass of a great meadow.
Waking from a dream, he comes into this outside world, and he meets the water rat, who introduces him to boating along the Thames and how pleasant that is, and this wide world of adventure and excitement. But then, as time goes on, we get this sort of a backstory where the mole gets retrofitted with family and friends and a history of his house underground. But at the very beginning of the book, it's sort of like he just explodes like Athena from the head of Zeus or something. It's
that's an image of mole doing that.
well, am I wrong? No,
I think that there's these pockets of like instinct, I think, that come along, and I find them very interesting, because I think that like it's not that dissimilar from human like longing and like wanderlust and stuff. But yeah, it's a little more I don't know, concentrated in here, but yeah, it's sort of like, especially with their like etiquette. I mean, these are all very like, these are gentlemen animals. So they're very polite to each other. They, practice good etiquette and manners and, hospitality and things like that. But then you'll get these paragraphs where, they have this like instinct to do something. And like, it might be badger wants to sleep, or, you know, rat wants to go on like a seafaring adventure or whatever. And they, it's like sort of unexplained. And there's actually that one section, I think towards the end, where rat is sort of overcome with wanting to like leave and go on an adventure. And, mole just kind of sits with him, and like, it's literally described as a seizure, that like rat is having this sort of fit, I guess. So yeah, it's very interesting, and that goes along with not being quite sure of how these are anthropomorphized.
So rat and mole have a pleasant life on the water bank. They are friends, or at least rat is friends with the celebrated toad, who is the most anthropomorphic of animals, and in some ways the least, because he's the one who seems to have the dealings with the world of humans the most, and yet and yet he does ridiculous things like dress himself up in disguise as a washerwoman, and then we're told that people peek under the petticoats and they see a toad, and it's supposed to be hilarious. It's supposed to be ridiculous, but you can never quite tell what the varying sizes of these animals are. There's a one point where Toad is picked up and flung off a barge by a barge woman. And so one assumes he's a toad that's maybe 6 inches long. But up till now, he's been mistaken for a human because he's wearing human clothes.
Well, there's so the version that I read this time. So like I said earlier, like early in the year, I listened to Terry Jones narrates the audiobook, the version that I listened to, which I highly recommend. If you are looking for one way to consume this book, listen to Terry Jones from Monty Python reading this book. It was like the highlight of my year. And then I'm reading this version now that's illustrated by a guy named Ernest Shepherd. And there's some tie-in as to how like Kenneth Graham considered him the like official illustrator of this. And one of the illustrations is of Toad next to the washerwoman that he impersonates. And yeah, like they look very similar. Like she's like a short, stout woman. And it's hilariously written that they have like a similar body type or whatever. It's very, very funny.
Yes, Ernest Shepherd, for those of you who don't know, was the original illustrator of the Pooh books. And so he's very well loved as that illustrator. He didn't originally illustrate Wind in the Willows, but he's probably the most famous illustrator of Wind in the Willows. But a lot of major children's books illustrators have done it, including Arthur Rackham, who's one of my favorite. I think it was the last book Arthur Rackham ever illustrated.
Yeah, this one was good. This one is this book, I guess it was celebrating 100 years. Let me see. This illustrations. Oh, the illustrations were first published in 1933 by Shepherd anyway.
Ah, right. Okay. The one I have has the illustrations by Paul Bransom. I think that those, I think that was the first illustrated edition. The original book was not illustrated. Yeah. So in any case, you probably know a little bit about, if you haven't read the books, you know that Toad is a upper class twit who is given to manias, and at first he wants to spend all his time running around in a caravan with his horse, and then he becomes obsessed with automobiles, and it's fascinating in a way because this is this coincides with the beginnings of commercially available automobiles, and maybe Graham is making some sort of a sly commentary on these mechanized creatures overtaking his beloved Thames Valley. But unlike the Disney film, which paints Toad as brash but deluded, he trades Toad Hall for a stolen automobile. In this book, Toad just simply steals an automobile
and then he tries to steal it again.
Yeah, and the second time he crashes it. Toad is not Toad is not simply reckless. He's straight out criminal in this book, which is kind of funny, actually.
It's incredible. This book is incredibly funny. So when I first listened to it, I was describing the scene to a friend of where he steals the car a second time. This time, like he's dressed as the washerwoman, and he sort of gains the car owner's sympathy, and they're like, "Oh, we'll give you a ride, washerwoman," blah blah blah. And then he sort of like cons his way into sitting up front because he wants like the fresh air. And then he's like, oh, let me drive. And they're like, oh, this bold woman, she's wonderful, blah, blah, blah. Not knowing it's Toad. And yeah, and then he gets in and they're like, and then he starts going crazy and, you know, yelling and driving like a maniac or whatever. And God, it was just like, as I was explaining this scene to a friend, I could not stop laughing. It's just so funny. I'm not quite sure why it tickles me so much, but it really does.
Right. And then paired with these incredibly brash, incredibly, subversive Toad stories, we have these very gentle, very quiet sequences with Rat and Mole, which I think make up probably the larger half of the book, but they...
Oh, yeah.
And they are also very funny, but they are very gentle, and they revolve around Mole's shyness and his slowly getting to learn what the world is like above ground, and Rat slowly introducing him into the river, into the river folk, and then warning him about the wild woods and not to go in there, which of course Mole eventually does, and where he finally meets Badger, who is this almost mythical creature at first, this kind of this strange hermit who is as frightening as he is compelling, and who saves them both from certain death in the middle of winter when they get lost in the woods. But then after that, Badger is just like another character. He's just there, you know. There's a way that this story has I would call it dream logic, which as I said at the beginning, Mole just appears out of nowhere. He meets Rat, and then suddenly they've known each other forever.
And, yeah, then they're living together. Yeah,
right. And then he's warned about Badger, who is a good beast, a noble beast, but certainly someone you need to treat with deference, and you have to approach cautiously, and certainly not during the winter when he is in hibernation. And then we meet him, and he's just a part of the group after that.
Yeah, he's fine. He reminds me of that scary old man in Home Alone. Like, you know what I mean? Like, there's all these like neighborhood myths about this guy, and like, oh, look at him, he's so creepy, what is he up to, and like, blah blah blah. And then yeah, you meet Badger, and he's like perfectly hospitable to them. Like, he, you know, is maybe a little grumpy about being woken up, but he's fine, and he's actually like quite nice. And later, I think they talk about the fact that he loves children, but children would never know that because like the myths exist about Badger being this awful creature. So, yeah, I like Badger, and he's very they make it very known that he like loathes society. Like, he's just not a fan of society at large.
Right. Now, Rat's main motivation is he loves the river. And he brings Mole to love the river. As you mentioned, there's a sequence towards the middle of the book where as they are working, I think it's as they're working their way home from Badger's house, Mole suddenly becomes cognizant that they are very close to his home and being above his home. And he feels drawn back instinctually to go underground. And when he goes there, there's this wonderfully strange passage where he talks about how shabby and small the place is, but how much he loves it, and how ashamed he is to have Rat be there, and how Rat knows exactly how to put Mole at ease by saying, "Oh, what a wonderful place! What you've done with this is so. I'm going to help you get it all back, you know, dusted up, and we'll have a feast out here." And they are able to put together a feast out of, I guess, a couple of tins of sardines and some sea biscuits, which is it's a kind of a miniature version of the way this book works, which is, on the one hand, we have these animals being drawn on entirely by instinct, and their proclivities and their habitats are determined by what kind of animal they are. But on the other hand, it's a kind of a miniature examination of Edwardian hospitality and mm-hmm. manners, and the ways in which to mitigate the uncomfortableness caused by a difference in class. So that's kind of what the book is.
Well, I think it's also, I mean, I think that it speaks to contemporary anxieties too, in that, like, everyone's always preemptively apologetic for their home. It doesn't matter. And like, if you brag about your home, or you say, look at how great my home is, you're Toad, you're Mr. Toad. You are like braggadocious and stuff. So, I mean, because the thing about Mole is that, yeah, he's like, oh, like, ignore how shabby my house is. But then they talk about how he has these, like, some of these, like, classical, like, busts and sculptures and pieces of artwork and stuff. So he has a nice home. I mean, I don't understand. And yeah, I mean, he hasn't been there for a while, so they do have to clean it up a little bit. But, and it's the same with Badger too, that they're like, oh, don't bother him. And then when they go in, he's like, come on in, it's fine. Like, you know, I don't know. It's very interesting that there's all these like social anxieties that are then, you know, relieved when you simply ask or follow your instinct or whatever. So yeah, that passage was interesting too, because when he's sort of having a freak out about how he would really love to go back to his home, but it's starting to snow, I think, and Rat is concerned with that. And then he sort of has this like emotional breakdown. And I thought that was interesting, because I think of these characters as being like old English guys, like, you know, on the Thames. And so to hear one like get so emotionally wrecked and then have Rat be so kind to him in that moment, it was very touching. And I don't know, I'm interested in Kenneth Graham and like his display of emotions that he has in this book. But yeah,
you mentioned that the Mole has these classical busts. That bespeaks sort of the strangeness of this book to modern readers. This book makes several classical references, including the fact that the final chapter, when Toad comes home, is called The Return of Ulysses, because he's going to rout out all these terrible weasels from his home, just like Ulysses killing off all the suitors. You're just supposed to roll with that, you know. You're not so. It's never explained. It's not. It's like it's just a title. And then of course there is possibly the strangest chapter in the book. The Piper at the Gates of Dawn, which is not just a Pink Floyd album, but it is actually a chapter in this book where Toad and Rat go in search of the child of an otter friend of theirs. What was his name? It was like Portly or something.
Portly. Yeah, Portly.
And and they find the child in the care of the god Pan. Although he's not named. They mentioned that he's holding some Pan pipes. But he's not named by name, and he's identified as a protector of animals. And a divinity to animals, and there's this marvelous like sequence where Mole asks Rat, "Are you afraid of him?" And he says, "Of him, never. And yet, I am afraid."
Yeah, it's very strange. It's very like the wise men in search of the holy child. It's very dream. I mean, a lot of this book is very dreamlike, but this chapter is basically, it seems to me, like, yeah, some sort of like fever dream almost,
which is helped along by the fact that Pan removes all memory of the encounter.
Yes. Yeah, I had to reread that chapter. It was very strange.
It's a beautiful chapter, and
it is.
And similarly, the chapter you were talking about later on in the book, where Rat meets a ship rat, an actual like Norwegian rat that is an actual rat aboard a ship that's been traveling through the Mediterranean, who discusses with Rat the adventures of the seafaring life. And as you mentioned, Rat just goes into this wild fever pitch fantasy about traveling around the world and seeing all these major sights, and he's like listing off, you know, Venice and
Corsica
and Istanbul and all this stuff, and it's like what, how does he know of these things? And ultimately, this chapter doesn't go anywhere. It's more about the expression of that sudden mania coming upon him, and at that point, Mole gets to be the sensible friend who sort of sits on Rat until he calms down. And both of these chapters, in one way or another, don't add up to anything that moves the plot along. But they certainly establish this fantastical dream state of this novel.
Yeah, there's a passage in what chapter is this? In Mr. Badger, where that I really loved, because I think it is emblematic of a lot of how the characters feel. But it's I think we can say maybe Mole is our everyman, I guess, as much as there can be in this book. And he says, I'm just going to quote it. Mole saw clearly that he was an animal of tilled field and hedgerow, linked to the plowed furrow, the frequented pasture, the lane of evening lingerings, the cultivated garden plot. For others, the asperities, the stubborn endurance, or the clash of actual conflict that went with nature in the rough. He must be wise, must keep to the pleasant places in which his lines were laid, and which held adventure enough in their way to last for a lifetime. So it's something that, like, I don't know, it's like this recognition that there is the wild wood, there is the wild world past the wild wood, but that, like, he finds comfort at home as well, too. And so I think there's a lot of commentary about one's home within this book.
Mole lives with a certain kind of anxiety that he is not experienced or competent enough to be a good friend to Rat, that he's not sophisticated enough to be a good friend to Toad, but he learns that he learns that there's a kind of a quiet dignity to the life that he lives as well, and the good friends support each other. And the funny thing is that in the end, Toad also comes around after his own fashion, although to the very last chapter, after he's succeeded in retaking Toad Hall after his adventures of having been in prison for stealing the car, of breaking free, and life on the lam, and of abusing barge women and crashing cars, he comes home, and there's never really much explained other than he waves some money at the problem and it kind of goes away. You know, he's able to pay everyone off, I guess, in the end, and nobody really wants to hold it against Toad because he's such a lovable scamp. But to the very end, it seems like his new mania is going to be that he is in love with this idea of himself as a man of largesse, and he's going to give speeches to his friend and throw dinner parties, and the friends are able to talk him down from that.
Yeah, he just wants to sing one little song about how great he is, and they say no, and then he eventually does it anyway. Yeah, he's hilarious.
Yeah. He's a terrible person, but you admire him a lot. I think that the
Christmas. Yeah. Do you have a character that you identified with the most?
I wish I could say I would identify with Mole because of being because I admire Mole's absolute humility and the way that he approaches life as an absolute beginner, which I think is very Taoist of him. But but I have to admit, I'm probably mostly like the water rat, in that I am sometimes a little too sure of myself and a little too convinced that I have the correct answer, and a little too convinced that I'm going to be the arbiter of what is correct or not. Why did you have a character?
Well, at first I thought Badger. I felt very like Badger in that, like, I don't know. I'm like, I'm sort of quick to judge and sort of I'm set in my ways in a lot of ways. But there were aspects of Rat that I thought were interesting. I mean, the fact that Rat is pretty much the through line for all of these characters, like they all encounter each other through Rat, and so he surrounds himself with these interesting characters, and I think that's a very cool thing. So yeah, so I don't know, I kept flip-flopping. I'm very curious, like Mole is, and I'm very naive and ditzy at some points. so I feel like Mole in those ways, but, and I'm sure we could all relate to Mr. Toad in, I don't know, in a fevered state of excitement or something. I'm not sure.
I was thinking about Badger because I read this book at the same time that I was rereading The Sword and the Stone, which will be, I believe, the episode of Sophomore Lit that will come out after this. And that also features, at least in its original form, features a badger as a main character, and a badger who in some ways is very close to this badger. And it would have been influenced in some ways by this book. But I was thinking about badgers and the interesting place that they play in children's literature. You know, we have Harry Potter, we have the Hufflepuffs, we have the Francis books, they loom large in children's literature. So I think any kid who grew up reading a lot of classic literature know badgers pretty well.
I will again refer to the Terry Jones narration in that, if you can't remember what Terry Jones' speaking voice is like, he has a very, very adorable tiny little speech impediment, I guess, like a little bit of a lisp. And it just added each character is added in tenfold to their adorableness made through his voice. So,
well, I know that Terry Jones did a movie of this too. I think in 1996, he and it had Steve Coogan as Mole and Eric Idle as Rat, and Terry Jones played Mr. Toad. So that's probably in some ways related to that. There was a sequel to the Wind in the Willows called the Willows in Winter, and it was written by who wrote that? I can't remember, but it's an okay book. It wasn't. Yeah. It was written, I think, in the early 90s. But what I remember about that was both The Wind in the Willows and The Willows in Winter got made into animated movies in the early 90s. And I remember in that one, Mr. Toad was played by Rick Mayall, who if you know him at all, you know him from The Young Ones as Rick.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, wow. that's amazing.
There was also a really great TV series that had like Michael Horton and Peter Salas and Ian Carmichael in it.
Wow.
So it's like this has been a very rich book for adaptation, including the fact that one of the first adaptations of this book was a stage play done by A.A. Milne in 1929. So Milne was obviously very much influenced by this book. So if you're a fan of Pooh And here I mean the original Pooh, the original stories, and you haven't read The Wind in the Willows, it's a good idea to go back and read this, because I think you'll see where Milne got a lot of what his ideas were from.
Well, speaking of Pooh, we forgot to mention what Toad says when he sees an automobile.
Oh, yes.
Bye-bye.
Yeah, go ahead.
He says, poop, poop.
Poop, poop. Yeah.
He says it a lot. It's very funny.
I'm going to close on a kind of a personal story here, and I'm going to try not to cry about this. But when I was in graduate school, I had a professor who was probably my favorite professor I ever had. She was a young professor who taught me 19th century American literature, Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman, and she was a great friend of mine. She had her kids just around the same time that my wife and I were having our kids. So it was kind of, while she was my professor, we were also kind of, you know, peers in a sense. Mm-hmm. And she unfortunately developed cancer, and she was able to fight it for a while, but she knew after a couple of years that she was dying. And I remember one time when I talked to her, we were talking about death, and she was talking about the things that she was doing to kind of prepare herself and the books she was reading. And she mentioned her teacher, who many, many years earlier had also succumbed to cancer, who was a professor of English literature, who's, I believe her specialty was Virginia Woolf, but who on her deathbed asked to be read The Wind in the Willows. And I would say that The Wind in the Willows is probably a book that would be on our short list of books to have read to you on your deathbed. So yeah. That's my recommendation, I guess.
Aw, that's a beautiful story. It's an amazing text, and I think it's another, as a children's librarian, I always encourage adults to read even contemporary children's literature, because it's just, there's so much rich text out there. But this, I'm surprised. I mean, again, I don't know that I've read a book and then reread the same book like a month or two after it. And it was, I smiled like the entire time I was reading this book. It's very, very beautiful.
Thanks for being on, and maybe next time we will do Spoon River Anthology or another children's book if you want to. We could also do Charlotte's Web, and then I could really break down crying.
Oh boy, you and me both, pal.
Thanks to my co-host Aaron Gambrell. The reading this time was by Kelly Guimont of the Mac Observer Daily Observations podcast. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by The Incomparable Network. Find more funny, smart podcasts online at theincomparable.com. Write to the show at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Look for us on the Incomparable membership Slack or join the Facebook page. Whatever you do, keep up the reading, because everything will be on the final.